Blog Talk Radio.
Delivering you guests from around the world and coast to coast, I'm your host, Bill Maupin. This is Out of Touch Radio. We are alternative radio with a twist on subject matter that really does matter. Be sure to visit our website at www.outoftouchradio.com. And our call-in number is 646-716-4228. Poltergeist may be a real phenomenon, albeit extremely rare. Just ask 51 police officers around the world in 17 cases since 1952 who claim to have seen poltergeist activity up close. More than a dozen of them were assaulted by what they said was a poltergeist, but none were seriously injured and no one was charged. One officer even pulled a gun on an unseen force. Our guest today, Michael Clarkson, and we will be discussing his latest work, The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. So, get ready.
All right. Thanks for joining us on this installment of Out of Touch Radio. And we've got a really good show for you today. We've got Michael Clarkson, and we'll be discussing his latest book, The Poltergeist Phenomenon. Unfortunately, our regular contributor, Gina Krizel, is ill. We're hoping that she gets better real quick. So her little bit that we normally do will be done by yours truly. We will be talking about understanding encounters with ghosts. Now, ghostly apparitions have been reported throughout the centuries. The purpose of these visitations and the types of ghosts vary widely. Ghosts are the spirits of people or things that once existed and now linger on, half in our world and half in the next. They come in many guises, and their characteristics vary widely. The purpose of these visitations are not quite understood. One of the most important divisions in types of ghosts is between conscious and unconscious ghosts. Unconscious ghosts are those that do not seem to be aware of the real present-day world or of living people who might see them. Conscious ghosts, on the other hand, interact with their surroundings or observers. The purpose is served by such ghosts break into four broad categories, although they sometimes will overlap. Warning ghosts appear to pass on a warning to the living. Playful ghosts, simply mischievous or playful. Informative ghosts are spirits who may wish to pass on information. Help-seeking ghosts need to ask the living for help. Now, there's a story, the original ghost story, one of the first ghost stories ever recorded, tells of the Greek philosopher Athenodorus, who took up a challenge to spend the night in a haunted house where he encountered a chain-rattling specter. Instead of fleeing in terror, he had the insight to understand that the ghost was actually trying to communicate and followed it to discover a set of unconsecrated remains. Now, once those remains were given a proper burial, the haunting stopped. Now, as a police reporter, he was twice nominated for the Michener Award for Public Service in Canada, and in 1980, he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for a story about reclusive J.D. Salinger, the author, who he met twice in New Hampshire. Clarkson has also than a sports reporter, interviewing famous athletes such as basketball legend Michael Jordan and the great Tiger Woods. Three of his books are on fear, competitive fire, intelligent fear, and quick fixes for everyday fears, which have been published in the United States, Canada, and in Europe. Let's welcome Michael Clarkson. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for joining us. You had an appearance last Friday on Coast to Coast, and really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I enjoyed being on there. I enjoy all my interviews, and I'm sure it's going to be fun tonight.
Yes, it will be. Yes, it will be. Well, let's take a step back and to the times when you started out as a reporter. You're also considered now as an expert in fear. Let's tell us a little bit how you got started in reporting, Mike.
Sure. Well, first of all, I was a sports reporter. I played soccer, and there was no one to hand in the reports of the games, so that's how I began. And I got out of sports for a while because I found it so interesting in investigative and police work. I was a police reporter for about 13 years. In fact, that's how I came across this interesting subject. And I also, in my police travels, came across many people in fearful situations. And fear interested me, and I wrote, as you said, a number of books on fear, and really put this poltergeist idea on the back burner for many years, in fact, 30 years from when it originated in my mind. But in the meantime, I think in my fear research that I found some type of link between fear and the fight-or-flight system and poltergeist energy, although as we'll talk about as we go along, Bill, you find out, I believe at least, that poltergeists, as you said, they're very rare. They're also very complex, and a number of quite unusual components have to come together for things that go bump in the day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's your definition of what a poltergeist is.
My definition, I guess, would closely resemble the definition of a parapsychologist who's now semi-retired in Georgia. His name is William Roll. He coined the term recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, RSPK for short, and that stands for poltergeist energy, bizarre movements of objects, noises, and other paranormal effects caused unconsciously by a person, otherwise known as poltergeist activity. Unlike Bill, it's close cousin psychokinesis, or PK. RSPK occurs spontaneously and repeatedly over a period of time.
Okay. Well, can I share a story with you?
Sure.
And this story is during a time about 8 years ago when my dad was passing on. He was actually in hospice, and the doctors had given me a call and told me that they didn't think he would make it beyond a 4 to 8 hour period. So I was showering, and my wife was at work, and the children were in school. No wind, it wasn't raining, clear, beautiful, sunny day. Out of nowhere, as I'm in the shower, I hear a door slam. Like, I've never heard a door slam before. Immediately, I assumed, well, maybe that was a sign. I really honestly felt that. Therefore, I called the hospice, and as I spoke with the nurse, she did advise me that he had expired about 5 minutes during the time that I was in the shower.
Wow.
Would that be considered a poltergeist?
I'm not sure. I guess it depends, Bill, on your definition of poltergeist. Yes, knockings is one dynamic of poltergeist activity. However, in the 75 cases I reviewed, I believe in all of them there were moving objects. So that would be my upfront in my definition of poltergeist would be moving objects. However, maybe 5 to 7% of the 75 cases I reviewed would seem to have a spirit linked to them. In other words, there's a Virginia psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Ian Stevenson, and he believes there's a link between the spirits and poltergeist activity, and he sometimes suggests to victimized families that a seance be held to cleanse a home. Then there's others believe the poltergeist agent is possessed by a spirit or demon, and they sometimes suggest a type of exorcism to bring the person back to himself or herself. But getting back briefly to William Rohl, who I believe is the foremost expert in poltergeist. He studied them for 30, 40 years, hundreds and hundreds of cases. He says he does not know of any case in which a spirit was responsible for a poltergeist incident. However, I quote him here saying, "We should not close our minds to that possibility, but they always seem to occur around a living person." So what you experienced, Bill, may very well have been very real, but it may have not have been a poltergeist, but it may have been spirit-related.
Correct. Okay, thanks for that. Should we be afraid of the activity that poltergeists can bring? Because as we know, when you talk about flying objects and things that are moving, you know, you would think that that could be dangerous, right?
Yes. As you mentioned earlier in the promo, I found in the 75 cases about 12 people received minor injuries, none of them serious. I believe the reason, and as far as I know, there's never been anyone killed by a poltergeist, although I think many poltergeist cases are not reported. I think the reason for this, Bill, that not many people are injured seriously, is that I believe the poltergeist energy comes from a person, mainly a young person, and the intent of that young person is not to hurt someone, but mainly to get attention in the household, in a house they feel where they're not listened to or they are repressed. So I don't think they're directing their energy in a mischievous way. It's certainly not malevolent. It may be a good time here to add to my definition of poltergeist and the common denominators, if you want, of the 75 cases I've reviewed. That being one of them, of course. Actually, two of them. Not many people injured and not a mischievous intent on the part of the young person. Anyway, I found in my travels and in my research that we're dealing, I think, here, at least by the definition I gave you earlier, we're dealing with haunted people rather than haunted buildings. In fact, I was going to call this book originally Psychic Tantrums because I think one of the components is a psychic one. And here are the common denominators, although I must stress, Bill, that each case has its own characteristics and idiosyncrasies. But the cases generally have, as I mentioned, a poltergeist agent, as we'll call him or her, usually, but not always, an adolescent entering puberty, immediately around who these strange activities and the furniture moving, etc., occur. And he or she is usually quite intelligent, above average in intelligence. Then there's usually some sort of repression or frustration of the poltergeist agent by others. Beyond that, a high level of stress in the household prior to the start of the poltergeist activity and continuing throughout the case. And most of these cases are actually short-lived. I would say a lifespan usually from 1 week to only several months. Now, to break down the dramatic events and the dynamics a little more than I did earlier, the dramatic events often include unexplained knocking. Perhaps you could attribute to that, the slamming door to that. Electrical malfunctions and movements of objects and furniture, which is first and foremost. Occasionally reported in my 75 cases are levitation of objects, electrical appliances working without power, and sudden fires and stones falling from nowhere. Very rarely reported are strange voices coming from the agent, apparitions, strange odors, cold spots, and water formings. So those are some of the common denominators. It's much more... I'm sorry, go ahead, Bill.
I was going to say, what about the ones that there are no child involved, as you were stating that in most cases that there is a child, adolescent involved?
Yes. Yes, there are exceptions. In fact, there's one going on right now in Canada. I cannot use this woman's name because of the stigma involved in the paranormal with the mainstream society and mainstream media and mainstream bosses. She doesn't want her boss to know about this, but she's in her mid-40s. And she may go through her case a bit right now, although I do have something to add down the road about these young people and the unusual brains they have and how they tap into electricity. But let's go into this woman's case first, if you want. She's in her mid-40s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. She lives in Canada. She's had experiences like poltergeist activity since 1993, perhaps even before, but in 1993 it started to escalate because she had this motor vehicle accident. In fact, she claimed she had an out-of-body experience while in a coma in the car. She said she saw her grandmother, whether it was a dream or an out-of-body experience, and her dead grandmother was calling, saying her, go back to the world, and she did. And when she came out of her coma, she started seeing things like white lights, and then again her dead relatives, particularly her favorite grandparents. And she also started moving things unconsciously with her mind, usually when her husband got her upset. Things as large as appliances, washers and dryers would start to move, and she got very upset about this and did not like it. She wanted to take drugs. She wanted to do anything to calm herself down because every time she got agitated, this RSPK would manifest itself. So what Sarah did, I call her Sarah and have a whole chapter, a long chapter for her in my book. Sarah decided to try to focus this energy into psychokinesis. Now, as I mentioned about RSPK, it usually involves young people. However, some of them grow older and are able to channel it into PK, which is generally known as moving things more consciously with your mind. What she did, Bill, was to create a little pinwheel, homemade pinwheel, with pencil and on top a little pinwheel made of paper. And she claims that she can move this by focusing tightly with her mind. She gave me a demonstration on Skype not long ago, and yep, there it went. The pinwheel was moving around and around. She was holding it on her lap for about 20 minutes. I suppose it could have gone on forever because she said she felt comfortable with me. Now, I can't prove that she didn't have a string or a wire attached, but I'm pretty skeptical. As I mentioned, came from that police and investigative background, and people have tried to sell me things over the years. But I was pretty impressed by that. But she took her act, if you want to call it, or her skill, to a laboratory in Laurentian University in Sudbury, Canada. She couldn't duplicate that in front of a very respected neuroscientist by the name of Dr. Michael Persinger. She said she didn't feel comfortable, as she did with me, though. She said that was one of the things that when she felt comfortable with someone, she could relax and she felt that her powers came to the forefront. It didn't work so well at Laurentian University. However, she went back to her hotel that night, and then a couple hours later, she phoned Dr. Persinger and said, I feel a little more relaxed and calm now. Can we try it again? So he sent an assistant over there. He couldn't come. And the assistant reportedly did see the pinwheel moving around and around. That was good for my book, I thought. So I contacted Persinger. Can you please give me this young man's name? Then I can put it in my book. And he says, definitely not, Michael. If you put this young man who's trying to get a job in science, you put his name linked to a paranormal, he's going to be blackballed forever. So that brings into play the stigma involved, and one of the reasons we sometimes can't get ahead in the paranormal research is the idea that many people have that it's hocus pocus.
Right, and Mike, you know, you being a professional reporter, that is. You had to take that into consideration when you pursued this, correct?
Yes, I took a chance. I knew what would happen. I've done some stories in newspapers previously about ghosts at Halloween and things like anniversary stories. Never done a widespread book on Poltergeist of the Paranormal. So I knew I was taking a chance because my reputation was one of sort of a nuts and bolts and not a scientist, but more science than not. And when I had another book, earlier book published last year, one of the reviewers in a national paper in Canada said in the review of this non-paranormal book that I was doing a book, for God's sakes, on Poltergeist. So I'm paraphrasing her by saying, well, what credibility does Clarkson have because he's doing a Poltergeist book? So there's that stigma again. But I knew the risk involved, and I felt I had, and I don't say in my book that I have proof that Poltergeist exists. I don't think anyone has that proof. However, you mentioned all those cops who I interviewed. I feel I have enough police officers at my back that, at the very least, I think it's very suggestive what I found, that some type of poltergeist energy exists. And I don't take police officers' testimony lightly.
That's right.
Because
that's right. And I was actually going to say that, is that your book holds a lot of water. You've got individuals who, on a daily basis, are taking and filing reports that are credible. They're right there. They know what's going on.
Yes, and they have so much to lose if they're not right, because you can imagine Burley cop going back to the cop shop and here's my report on Poltergeist. Well, he's going to be laughed out of the police station, or he's going to lose his credibility. Another thing is that police officers tend to be excellent witnesses. Eyewitness evidence, as you know, let's say for paranormal events, is probably the weakest form of evidence. However, police officers are not normal witnesses. If you take five people off the street, Bill, and ask them about the same accident they've seen, you'll get five different versions. But cops are a little bit different. They're trained to watch the action when it's going fast. They're also trained to be very very skeptical, and also suspect. When you have an adolescent always in the room when this stuff is going on, the cops are going to start to watch this person. And if they have been there for days or weeks and not caught that young person cheating and still seen this activity going on and put it in the report, then I tend to believe them.
That's right. Sure. Well, let's talk about some of the police officers now. You traveled not only in the U.S. but in Canada. Any other specific countries that you've actually visited?
No, but I've gathered reports from far away is India. In fact, there was a case only two or three years ago in, believe it or not, the cops didn't have to go back to file this report. This one happened in the police station in, I'm not going to pronounce it, but in a town or small city in India. And about a dozen cops there claimed that they saw the effects of a poltergeist, and some of the officers claimed they were victims of it. According to this one constable, his name was Darbar, he said this unseen force terrorized the police station for more than a month, overturning furniture, moving chairs, and even assaulting police officers. He said that it pushed the police officials off tables and chairs. Some of them even complained of chest pain in the middle of the night, and they felt as if someone had jumped on their chest. And there were others who felt that someone was strangling them. This is a little bit different than the criteria I'd set down for most of these cases, the trends, but there's a lot of similarities there. Unfortunately, the investigators didn't do a very good job, a parapsychologist, of coming in and investigating this case, as is the case, sadly, the case for, I would say, the majority of poltergeist investigations. The investigators either aren't allowed in the house, or they come in when the poltergeist activity is dissipating. And the main reason for that, Bill, is that the families don't want publicity. They've got nothing to gain, usually, by having their...
And everything to lose.
Yeah. They have their dirty laundry. And usually, often these kids are troubled kids. If nothing else, the family doesn't want the neighborhood to find out that they've got a troubled kid who's making things move. So, unfortunately, we don't get too much in the way of science coming into these investigations. However, on this note, if we got a couple of minutes here, I can go into what they have found about poltergeist agents.
Sure, please do. Go right
after
ahead.
After the fact, usually, they say it's hard to come into the home when all this crap is going on. I call it crap, but bizarre activities. after the fact, they've examined some of these young people and found that they, many of them have unique brains. In other words, a slightly higher rate of epilepsy and schizophrenia. There was a parapsychologist, he's no longer with us, his name was Andrew Green of London. He said that some of these agents suffer from what he called the front temporal lobe epilepsy. That's a brain disorder in which people can suffer blackouts lasting from a minute to half an hour. And during these blackouts, an unknown power of the mind may be released, which can cause objects to move. But as I said earlier, Bill, there's more to it than that. In fact, I would say there has to be so many components come together for this unusual energy, I would almost call it the perfect psychic storm. And the next component is the energy that these people, mainly young people with the unusual brains, seem to tap into nearby sources of energy, such as household electricity, geomagnetic storms in the area, magnetic fields around the building or the home they're living in, and even from their own mind-body. I think, Bill, sometimes we forget that we have electricity and things like the beat of our heart. We have it. Electrical signals move along your nerve cells so that, you know, when you walk across a carpet and you touch the doorknob, right, then zap. I think all your listeners could probably relate to that. So very unusual circumstances come together, but it seems to have happened all over the world and throughout history. And I guess that's another piece of suggestive evidence, is that these cases are reported independent of one another, and yet they all seem to have the same dynamics.
Okay, and we're going to take a break now, and when we get back, I'd like to talk about how do we get rid of a poltergeist. So we'll be right back.
Our guest today, Michael Clarkson, whom is a nonfiction author and professional speaker who has spent 37 years as a print journalist, winning numerous awards for his investigative pieces, including the Canadian National Newspaper Award twice. He brings to you his latest work, The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances. Take it from me, it's an incredible book. Just ask 51 police officers around the world in 17 cases since 1952 who claim to have seen poltergeist activity up close. More than a dozen of them were assaulted by what they said was a poltergeist, but none were seriously injured, and no one was charged. One officer even pulled a gun on an unseen force. These are shocking, scary, and real ghost stories. The Poltergeist Phenomenon, an in-depth investigation into floating beds, smashing glass, and other unexplained disturbances by Michael Clarkson. You can purchase his book by visiting Amazon.com or your local bookstore. A poltergeist is defined as a disturbance or energy with bizarre physical effects of paranormal origin that suggests mischievous or destructive intent, such as breaking or moving objects and loud knocks or noises. Thank you. Again, be sure to purchase this book by visiting Amazon.com or your local bookstore. And now, let's get back to the show.
All right, Mike, how would one get rid of a poltergeist? In your investigations, I'm sure you ran across some cures for poltergeists.
Sure. I don't know if we call them cures, but there seems to be some methods to at least ease the situations. As I said earlier, most of these cases die a natural death, Bill, after a few weeks or months. Also, sometimes it eases the energy with the easing of stress in a household, because repression, suppression seems to be one of the major causes. Sometimes the occurrences end when the agent realizes he or she is the cause. Other times it helps if you bring a psychotherapist in, or even sometimes a parapsychologist. Now, exorcisms, as I found, don't seem to work. However, clergy and parapsychologists report some relief to the victims when they counsel a family. And Alan Murdy, who was the former chairman of England's Ghost Club Society, that billed itself as the oldest in the world, just backtracking for a minute, he also thinks that in poltergeist cases, buildings are not haunted, the people are. Murdy said that if the stress in a family is addressed, the paranormal activity will often disappear. And also in England, a parapsychologist by the name of Stephen Mara, he says, most of all, our investigations help the family through the crisis, giving them information, support, and assistance, and we try to identify what is causing the occurrences. Sometimes, Bill, simply listening to, if it is a young person who is the center of the activity, listening to them, and in one case in Baltimore, it was a case of this young man who felt he wasn't receiving the creative feedback. I think he was an artist. And the parapsychologist at the time, his name was Nathan Fedort, he suggested to the family that they give this boy encouragement for his writing and artwork, which he was frustrated over. The family agreed, and when they did give him credit for his work, not long after the disturbances ended. And strange as it sounds, Bill, a poltergeist case can actually be good for relieving tension in an unusual family situation. There was a British psychologist by the name of Dr. John Layard. He said that poltergeists are not chance phenomena, but have a definite purpose. It is a curative one, having for its object the resolution of psychological conflict. Often the poltergeist agent has no other way to relieve the unusual buildup of frustration or tension, whether it is psychological or sexual. And the sexual part comes in. I hate to leave that word hanging there. But the sexual part is another component of this, in that it seems like when a young person is involved, they're almost always going through puberty. Now, the theory there, and many of these things are theories, I can't prove them. The theory there is that during puberty, which is a mysterious thing to begin with, the pineal gland in the brain releases some sort of unusual energy, sexual energy. Some people also think that is related to creative energy. So that, Bill, may be another thing in the mix. So if I guess that may be another warning sign, although for families, although, I mean, there's millions, probably billions of kids going through puberty, and they never make things
right
with their mind.
That's right. What are some of the most famous poltergeist cases and best documented that in your investigation?
Sure. Before I go into that, during the break, I was thinking about what you said, Bill, about your father and the slamming door. Well, that brought me back to, and I was born in England. I wasn't there then, but my grandmother was into reading tea leaves. In England, before there were tea bags, the tea leaves would make a formation on the bottom of the cup when you were getting down to the bottom of the cup of tea. And my grandmother claimed that she got up in the morning, and when she finished her tea, she looked at the tea leaves, and she said at that moment she knew her husband was dead, and he'd been in the hospital, and Sure enough, when she went to the hospital, her husband had died. So that could have been her
amazing.
Sliding door. Have you heard that? Have you heard about that before, the tea leaves?
I've heard of tea leaves, but nothing of that magnitude.
Yeah, I don't know if they've gone out of vogue or not with the invention of tea bags, perhaps, but yeah, I thought that was an interesting story. Nevertheless, yeah, but getting back to your question, there are both highly publicized cases and well-documented cases. I'll go into both. A very highly publicized case, which involved many police officers, was in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1974. And the police in that case were called into a house after ashtrays and furniture had reportedly flown on their own. And the activities seemed to center around this 10-year-old girl. Her name was Marcia. She was maybe 4'6" and 70 pounds soaking wet. Here's some of the reports of the officers. A patrolman, John Holdsworth, he said he saw a 450-pound refrigerator, quote, lift slowly off the floor, turn, and then set down again. And then a big TV set, of course, in the old days, the TV sets were big and heavy, seemed to float in the air and crash to the floor. I checked to see what had caused it to fall, but I saw nothing. Patrolman Joseph Tomick, I just couldn't believe what I saw. Shelves fixed to the wall began to vibrate until they were loose, then flew through the air. I looked for evidence that someone was making it happen, but I couldn't find anything. No wires, nothing. Then I watched as the same big TV fell over. Patrolman Cal Leonzi. It was unreal in the house. A picture fell off the wall and the TV set shook. It seemed like everything was moving. So, and just to close up on that case, there were many other police officers' reports, but the family didn't know what to do beyond the cops, so they brought in two priests who blessed the house, and they saw nothing to suggest that evil spirits were responsible. There was a reverend by the name of Reverend Charbonneau. He claimed that it was a classic case of psychic energy, and no exorcism was called in on that case. Before I get into the documented case, however, maybe you can do a little side trip here. I would like to finish that thought on ghosts. I mentioned it in passing earlier, but I've got a couple of cases here. If you want me to, I can go into a little bit of detail of what seemed to be ghost-related.
Yeah, please do, Mike.
One was pretty recent. It was March 2010, small town Cork City, Ireland. This family abandoned their three-bedroom house when they reported occurrences over several weeks, which they blamed on evil spirits. Now, there were reported flying ashtrays, glasses, screams in the night, glowing orbs hovering in the air, a cooker turning itself off and on, cushions flipping over on a couch, a chair shaking while someone was praying, and a young boy tossed out of bed. Again here, there were two priests who became involved. They celebrated masses, and a shaman by the name of a religious leader by the name of Paul O'Halloran. He led an exorcism, but the occurrences continued. O'Halloran believed that three restless ghosts were caught in a time warp and haunting the property. I quote him here, "The reason they are making so much noise is they want the issue to be sorted out and they want to be freed. I feel the energy is an angry one and needs to be moved on." So that's one case there. Do you want me to read another ghost case?
Yeah, please do.
Manchester, England this time. I don't know why we have a lot of reports in the UK, but 1995 Manchester. Family will call the Gardner family. A young woman and a ghost apparently were involved. And in some of these cases, the reason I use these is it seems like, again, young people, their energy making things move, but an argument could be made from certain quarters that the spirit is moving indirectly through this young person. Anyway, this was another unusual aspect of this case was that there was water found seeping through the house. At one point, one of the parapsychologists had an umbrella, believe it or not, to stop the water falling from the ceiling. The family said they sometimes heard unexplained coughing and the smell of licorice, which was also similar to the smell of flavored cigarette paper in the house. The parapsychologist, Stephen Mera, he claims that, among other things, he was hit in the back by an unknown force, which left welts in his back. And then he smelled a sweet smell of pipe tobacco in the air. And after investigating further, Mera found out that a man who had died in the house used to smoke a pipe. Roman Catholic Church vicar conducted a blessing of the home and believed that poltergeist activity was focusing on the daughter and the granddaughter. These mysterious water pourings apparently followed the family when they moved to another home. I found that in a few cases, the poltergeist energy follows the family or the young person. Stephen Mara, the parapsychologist, wrapped up the case by wondering, was it a case of the family being plagued by a poltergeist, or was Mrs. Gardner haunted by her late husband? Perhaps he was angry that she had remarried, and Mara said that we might never know. So that's a couple of ghost cases. I've got another case for you if you want, or we can go on to another issue.
Well, actually, I wanted you to give out your web address, if you could, please.
Sure. Unfortunately, my website is down right now, but people can get my information, my book about me and my book, through at www.newpagebooks.com. That's my publisher. You can also get my book on Amazon.
Yeah. And what do you have going on for the rest of the year here?
I'm looking at several things. I like to I've had so much of police reporting and reporting on the underbelly, as it were, a society, that I'm looking for different things, and I'm not sure if another poltergeist book is in the works. However, I've received an enormous amount of attention from this book. I've done probably more than 40 interviews, radio interviews, for this book, which is more than all my other books, nonfiction books on fear, so perhaps it's worth another look, and perhaps people will come forward with other cases.
Sure. And, you know, there seems to be a rash of reality shows that surround about hauntings and ghosts. Why do you think it's so popular? Why all
sure.
of a sudden there's this
yeah.
breakout?
I'm not sure. Things go tend to go in cycles. We had the Criminal Minds type television shows still dominating, still number one, I guess, as genre. However, you're right. The PSI shows, the haunted house shows are gaining in popularity. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure how much good they do as far as knowledge. I'm sure there are some legitimate shows right now on TV. But I don't watch TV, so I shouldn't really be commenting that much. But it seems like some of them seem strictly for entertainment value, and they may turn off the average viewer. But I know one thing, Bill, that as far as movies go, I think movies have done a great disservice to the poltergeist over the decades as far as legitimacy goes. Although I enjoy
sure.
poltergeist movies. I mean, we go for entertainment movies. I go to be entertained. Yeah.
But are there actually any that you would actually say has significance and gives credibility to this subject
mm-hmm.
matter?
Yes, there's one. First of all, the first poltergeist movie was very, very entertaining, but very little in the way of facts. The movie The Exorcist, your listeners may remember from 1973, that had some basis of fact, and that was one starring Linda Blair where head was spinning around in the bed. And this was reportedly based, at least partly, on a true poltergeist-slash-possession case from Washington, D.C., or I'm sorry, Maryland. It was in the Washington Post in 1949, in which there was an alleged exorcism of a 13-year-old boy who was apparently the only child of a dysfunctional family. There were bizarre noises coming from the bedroom walls, furniture moving, and objects. A Lutheran minister reportedly saw a bed move and a chair flip the boy onto the floor. And the boy apparently showed hysterical tendencies and believed he was possessed. And then a team of priests performed a number of exorcisms, which apparently were unsuccessful at the time. But the occurrences stopped after about 4 months. William Blatty, who wrote the 1971 book The Exorcist, he latched onto that case. And I think part of his book was based on that case and then the movie 2 years later.
Hmm. Okay. Have you yourself ever seen a paranormal phenomenon, a poltergeist?
Again, the definition comes into play. I'm not sure if I've seen a paranormal event. However, I've been part of some what I would term super-natural events, but they generally relate to fear, and manipulating my fear hormones. As I said, I studied fear for many years and have been a deadline writer for many years, so I had pressure on me lots of times. I was an amateur athlete, and athletes often report being in the zone, and that's what I would call it, mental powers. I've had almost like what I would describe out-of-body experiences when I focused very intently under pressure, and I think that's part of the fight-or-flight system when your mind and your body come to your aid when you're under crisis, and they pump out powerful hormones like dopamine and testosterone and adrenaline. It actually can help you build focus so incredibly under pressure that you seem to have more time to think. In fact, an argument could be made that you do, because part of fight or flight, I found, is something called tachypsychia. It's Greek for speed of the mind. People who are in life-threatening situations report that the actions seem to be in slow motion, but I think that's nature's giving you the action one frame at a time so that you can deal with this situation. Police officers reported in one case that this gunman turned slowly around and gave them time to shoot. Well, I think that was their fight-or-flight system kicking in, along with their training and their experience. But the hormones acted as an additive, so it gave them an extra mental power. I think that's an area I'd like to study more. And I mean, if we all could control our minds more than we do, and I'm sure we have many more mental powers than we're tapping into.
Sure. Well, here's something you might want to check into with your next book or investigation, would be demonic spirits that may be able to come through the home via computer.
Well,
do you think that's possible?
I guess it's possible. I don't want to make a comment because I tend to give beliefs and theories through the research I've already done. I'm not saying it's not possible. I know we're entering a new age. Who knows? Who knows the powers and the effects of computers? I mean, people manipulate computers all the time for their own good, and there's some amazing things going on with computers. I mean, I got hacked to the point that someone, who knows where they were, Russia or Middle East, they got all my friends' email addresses, and they sent them a letter saying I was in England. I needed $2,500 to get out of England, so my friends were phoning me offering money. Now, that's far
amazing.
From demonic possession, but those are demonic people, I think.
No, you're right. Absolutely. Because you wonder what goes through. Okay, there you go. So, I mean, we run into people every day, right? And people that we haven't met, people that we know, sometimes they act a little bit differently, right? Including ourselves. You know, that energy there possibly could, and some tend to really have problems consistently. Possession, maybe?
I'm not sure. I know we have a terrific problem these days with stress. I mentioned the fight or flight system. Well, all stress, as far as
I'm
concerned.
Great analogy. I love the fight or flight theory.
I'm sorry. Do you want me to enlarge on that a bit?
No. I love the fight or flight theory that you have there.
Sure. The downside of fight or flight, though, Bill, is something everybody can relate to. It's stress. I think all stress is fear energy. It comes from our fight or flight system. Every day, the average person's fight or flight system, believe it or not, kicks in 35 to 40 times a day. It's usually very small when we face challenges, when we're on the phone, we get in a bit of an argument, we feel tension in our shoulders. That's the fight or flight system kicking in. It's giving us extra power to fight or run away. It's the same system we've had for a million years, and it's usually for physical purposes. But now, Bill, you know, as you say, we've got computers, we've got mental challenges, we've got social challenges. So when our fight or flight system kicks in, we've got to divert that into a different response away from stress. Otherwise, it'll cause us a heck of a lot of distress, causes a lot of anxiety. So we've got to learn to channel that, and if we can learn to focus it, and everybody focuses
good for the body.
Yeah, everybody focuses differently. You have your own techniques on how to focus, but you've got to do it under pressure when you're distracted by pressure.
Sure. And what are some of the things that you really do not want to do when you have a poltergeist phenomenon?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Some of the things that you really don't want to do in your investigations, I'm sure there were some things that these individuals should not have done.
Sure.
Under these circumstances.
Yeah, first and foremost, the tension in the household. The more the tension ratchets up, then the more chance for the poltergeist energy to get not more angry. I guess angry is a word, though, because these young people were angry. Their fight-or-flight systems were kicking in. So the more stress in the household, the more pressure the parents are putting on the kids, then the more things are going to go flying around the room. So to ease the stress in the house is, as I said earlier in that little segment about what to do when you have a poltergeist, that is very key.
Okay, thanks. You know, you were talking about moving things with the mind. Can the average person, you believe, develop the ability to move things with the mind?
I'm not sure. I think it's quite possible. We have many many talents we're not using, mental talents, and sometimes most of the time, I guess, they're very sporadic. They just pop up when we least expect it, and we don't seem to be able to control them. Now, there have been some tests done of people, PK people. The most convincing, I think, was a woman called Nina Kulagina. I'll spell that because your listeners may be able to YouTube her. Kulagina. She was in Russia in the 1950s and 60s. Initially, she had built some poltergeist activity in her apartment. But the Soviet scientists got interested enough that for three decades, they studied this woman, and they tested her in closely controlled conditions and claimed she could move things by focusing tightly with her mind, and no one ever caught her cheating. Now, it's easy to fake on YouTube these days. It's easy to fake videos. In fact, but 40, 50, 60 years ago, not so much the case. So if your listeners go to YouTube and type in that woman's name, they may see some amazing things. But getting back to overall general question, there was some scientists at Princeton University who believed people, the average person, could move things in their mind. They had a laboratory up until a few years ago. Professor Robert John, J-A-H-N, he said he produced good experimental data to support the existence of PK. He said that his scientists invited people in, everyday people, and they were able to influence small balls and pendulums through the force of their mind. But again, very inconclusive. These things generally do not hold up to science. In fact, you remember you called Uri Geller, the famous spoonbender.
Yeah.
He was tested many times and seemed like legitimate tests, but then he came on the Johnny Carson show and couldn't do it. Now, in that regard, he felt he was under pressure, similar to Sarah, the woman who did it for me on Skype. In this light, however, there was a famous fiction author by the name of Michael Crichton. He said he attended spoonbending parties. Yes. We got a minute to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
In his 1988 book, nonfiction book called Travels, he said he had a successful experience at a spoonbending party. I don't bring up spoonbending to answer your question, but you'll get to the point in a minute. When he went to this party, he said he looked around the room and saw little children, 8 or 9 years old, bending large metal bars. He said that it was hard to feel, however, that it was any kind of mystery. He said you just rubbed the spoon for a while, focused, and pretty soon it got soft and bent. The only thing I noticed, he said, is that spoon bending seemed to require a focused in attention. You had to try to get it to bend, and then you had to forget about it. Maybe talk to someone else while you rub the spoon and look around the room. To end this quote, Crichton said, "This seems to me to confirm the idea that so-called psychic or paranormal phenomena are misnamed. There's nothing abnormal about them. On the contrary, they're utterly normal. We've just forgotten we can do them. The minute we do them, we recognize them for what they are and think, so what?" that's the experience I've had with these in-the-zone experiences I've had in basketball and right at the deadline pressure where I perform way above my capabilities. It just seemed natural to me. I didn't think about it. I got out of my own way. In fact, I didn't think about these things until 2 or 3 days after. So I think if people are trying to move things with their mind, yes, they need focused attention. They also need training. But in the end, I think they've got to get out of their own way. And when they do that, it seems like a very natural experience.
You know, and with that said, the pyramids, you know, something there took place. And you wonder if that's one of the things that took place. Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Mike, and hope to have you back soon.
Thanks very much, Bill.
When will your website be back up?
It won't be for a while, though, but newpage.com is the best place to reach me.
Okay. Thanks again for joining.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
There he is, Michael Parker, Upper Park. Be sure to subscribe to Amazon. I want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us. Hope to see you next time. Until next time.
Race to